Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. What does the Penn State sex abuse scandal tell us about what is referred to as the military-industrial academic complex? Why is the rape of children called by so many other names? What did child welfare agencies know, and when did they know it? Why is the first priority not protecting children, and why are they treated as disposable? Our guests are Dr. Henry Giroux, author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, and Phoebe Jones of the Every Mother is a Working Mother Network that coordinates a group called DHS, Give Us Back Our Children, and gentrification of downtown Los Angeles and protests against it, including the recent art walk protest by Occupy LA activists. We speak with Pete White, founder and co-director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, known as LA CAN. Also, our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Rose Katabchi for Pacifica Radio. Indian fishermen who survived a hail of gunfire from a U.S. Navy boat off the coast of the United Arab Emirates disputed U.S. claims that their boat drew fire after ignoring warnings to steer clear of the American vessel. One Indian was killed and three others injured yesterday when the American refueling ship fired on the fishing vessel, which the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet said approached at high speed and ignored repeated warnings. The incident highlighted the potential for a rapid escalation of tensions in Gulf waters, where U.S. forces are expanding their presence as Washington ramps up pressure on Iran over its nuclear program. The fishermen, hospitalized with gunshot wounds after the incident near Dubai's Jebel Ali port, said today that they received no warning before the U.S. craft opened fire and that their craft had attempted to avoid any contact with it. The National Urban League says President Barack Obama may have a tougher time winning North Carolina, Virginia, and Ohio in November should black voter turnout fall at least 5 percentage points below the record levels that helped put him in the White House. Black voter turnout of 64.7% was significant in Obama's victory in 2008, and African Americans are considered solidly behind Obama now, but the Urban League says a drop in black turnout to about 60% or below could cost him. The league bases its conclusion on all other voting patterns remaining the same, but anything could change, such as a rise in Hispanic turnout, and offset a drop in black voter turnout. Obama is to speak at the group's New Orleans convention, which begins July 25th. The California State University Board of Trustees is set to meet today in Long Beach. The board is expected to approve raises for the new president at San Francisco State, as well as two other presidents. Those raises would be paid for through donated money. The CSU is also dealing with the possibility of losing $250,000 in funding from the state. The receipt of that sum of money is dependent on whether voters approve Governor Jerry Brown's tax increase in November. If the measure fails, CSU is warning that as soon as January, there could be fewer students admitted to state schools and, for those who are admitted, further tuition increases. CSU says there would also be major cuts to class availability and staff layoffs. The CSU had imposed a 9% fee increase for students enrolled in the upcoming fall semester. State lawmakers approved a 2012 budget last month, giving CSU $125 million next year if it refunds the extra 9% back to students. The city of San Bernardino has delayed a decision to declare a fiscal emergency to avoid mediation and head straight to federal bankruptcy. The city council voted yesterday to delay the vote until tomorrow. Members expressed a desire for more time to look over financial information and talk to constituents. The emergency declaration would let the city of 210,000 people avoid a neutral evaluation otherwise required under California law before filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. Council members also voted to immediately begin formal negotiations with employee unions as they struggle to meet payroll. San Bernardino could become the third California city since last month to file for bankruptcy, following Stockton and Mammoth Lakes. The city faces a roughly $45 million budget shortfall even after slashing spending. San Bernardino County officials held the first of several forums to discuss a proposed eminent domain law to curb the number of foreclosures among inland communities. Just a week ago, the Homeownership Protection Program appeared to be a long shot, but now the proposal is being seen by many as a possible solution to help distressed homeowners. Ernesto Arce reports.
San Bernardino County officials have set up a joint task force along with the cities of Fontana and Ontario to look into eminent domain as a way to seize underwater properties. The task force set up its first meeting over the weekend. Struggling homeowners listened intently, eager to learn the details of the proposed program. The meeting was also attended by real estate industry professionals, who oppose what they say would be yet another catastrophic decision by local elected leaders. County and city officials will vote on the proposal at the conclusion of a series of town hall meetings next month. In Los Angeles, I'm Ernesto Arce, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. In 2011, following a two-year grand jury investigation, 68-year-old Gerald Arthur Jerry Sandusky, a retired football coach at Penn State University, was arrested and charged with 52 counts of sexual abuse of 10 boys over a 15-year period. Four of the cases were dropped. But on June 22, 2012, Sandusky was found guilty on 45 of the 48 remaining charges. Sandusky has maintained his innocence, saying he was merely horsing around with the boys while taking showers with them. Though he has not been sentenced yet, several legal experts say Sandusky will almost certainly spend the rest of his life in prison. A report led by former FBI Director Louis Free was released on July 12th, and according to the findings, four of the most powerful people at Penn State University, the late coach Joe Paterno, athletic director Tim Curley, former vice president Gary Schultz, and former president Graham Spanier, failed to protect against a child sexual predator harming children over a decade. Serious charges indeed. Joe Paterno died shortly after the scandal broke, but should the others face prison sentences along with Sandusky? The scandal raises a number of serious questions about the role of what Dr. Henry Giroux calls the military-industrial academic complex and how a market-driven values in society create an atmosphere where children are raped, considered disposable, and otherwise abused. Let us go now to a clip on the Penn State University scandal.
The most powerful men at Penn State failed to take any steps for 14 years to protect the children who Sandusky victimized.
Callous and shocking. That's how former FBI director and lead Penn State investigator Louis Free described the actions of Penn State's top officials, who he believes covered up the Jerry Sandusky sexual abuse scandal to avoid bad publicity.
Although concern to treat the child abuser humanely was expressly stated, no such sentiments were ever expressed by them to Sandusky's victims.
His 267-page report shows most of the evidence came through emails, with Free pointing the finger at late head coach Joe Paterno, Penn State's former president Graham Spanier, vice president Gary Schultz, and athletic director Tim Curley. Paterno admitted to learning about an incident in 2001 involving Sandusky and a boy in a shower. He told Curley instead of calling police, and together they decided not to alert authorities. This happened after all four knew of past sexual allegations against Sandusky. Last month, a jury found Sandusky guilty of 45 counts of abusing children. he will spend the rest of his life behind bars while Penn State tries to move on and heal from the black eye this scandal has left behind.
I think it would be up to a grand jury and a law enforcement officer to make decisions whether it meets the elements of criminal offenses.
Attorneys for Sandusky's victims and others considering civil lawsuits are also combing over this report because it could be used in future litigation. Brandy Hitt, ABC News, Philadelphia.
Right, and that was a report from ABC News on the FBI director, Louis Freeh's report on the Penn State scandal. I'd now like to introduce our guest. I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth, Dr. Henry Giroux. Dr. Giroux, thank you so very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Okay, Dr. Giroux holds the Global TV Network Chair Professorship at McMaster University in English and Cultural Studies Department. His primary research areas are cultural studies, youth studies, critical pedagogy, popular culture, media studies, social theory, and the politics of higher and public education. And of course, he, as we said in our intro, he has written a book entitled Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability. And so we're very glad to have you, Dr. Giroux. Also on the line with us, I'd like to welcome Dr. Phoebe Jones. Phoebe, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Dr. Phoebe Jones of the Every Mother is a Working Mother Network, based in Philadelphia, and coordinates a group called DHS, Give Us Back Our Children, based at the Crossroads Women's Center. And they did a protest, that group, following when the Sandusky scandal broke. Dr. Giroux, I'd like to start with you. You are saying that crime pays for the rich and the powerful, and that the justice system works in this country when it comes to prosecuting the rich and powerful who engage in a bottomless pit of corruption and moral irresponsibility. And that is your quote. The connection here with the Penn State scandal.
Well, I mean, the connection here is that children have become, within this larger market-driven culture, one of our lowest priorities, particularly poor minorities. I mean, it seems to me that when you look at what's happened to the university, you have to understand it within a broader context of the institutional of forces that are affecting a whole range of institutions. And it seems to me that when we talk about institutions that are now being taken over by big money, taken over by corporate values, taken over by managerial modes of governance, increasingly these institutions really care very little about the youth that they serve. I mean, increasingly they're far more concerned about making money, about power, about establishing governing structures that are not responsive to the needs of the people they serve. And I think that Penn State is basically exemplifies that. And I think it'd be terrible not to understand this scandal. We're in a much broader set of economic, political, and social forces in which we have turned the corner on youth. No longer do we see them as worthy of a social investment, but we largely see them as a problem that we'd like to see go away.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you make the case that what is on trial here is a society governed by market-driven values. I mean, with all of the discussion around the Penn State abuse scandal that has gripped the nation, and even when former FBI Director Freeh made his report, when asked if those who covered up the Penn State officials who basically let this thing continue through their cover-up, whether or not they would go to prison, he said, well, that's up to other people to decide. I mean, what do you think? It does seem to me as though these people should be going to prison.
I think it suggests two things. One, I think we're talking about a culture in which money and power and masculine privilege have basically assumed a position where they believe they're basically unaccountable. And I think that when you look at the nature of this particular crime, you know, where the reputation of a winning football team is more important than reporting the raping of children and basically looking the other way in order to protect both a coach and a storied football team, if that isn't a criminal act, I mean, I basically don't know how to define a criminal act. But then again, as I look at the outside of Penn State and you look at the broader culture, you see a very strange alignment with respect to that issue, with the likes of you know, these CEOs who are doing all kinds of horrendous things to the economy and basically are walking away from it. So there seems to be the story here seems to be, look, if you commit horrendous crimes and you have enormous amounts of power and money, then basically you're unaccountable, even if these crimes are so egregious that they seem to suggest that they point to the raping of children. And I think this particular story so illustrates the kind of moral coma, the tsunami of slime, as one journalist put it, that has now invaded particularly the universities. They've completely lost their mission. I mean, they no longer have any sense of what it means to be democratic public cultures. They're governed by managerial structures and a kind of corporate influence now that basically suggests that they're really about making money, big sports, big empires, and it seems to me we need to take this sort of thing very seriously as a kind of wake-up call that represents not just an attack on young people, but a really serious attack on democracy itself.
Yes, and Dr. Phoebe Jones, bringing you into this discussion, I'll just call you Phoebe, I've known you long enough now for that, but you all organized a protest when this scandal broke out. Actually, it was a little after the scandal broke out back in December. What were you concerned about?
Well, we were concerned because we felt there was a whole other people who were responsible who were really getting away with it, and that was child welfare services. I mean, your other guests talked about the academic military-industrial complex. Well, there's also a foster care industrial complex, and it was really falling under the radar, and we had a protest outside the Department of Human Services in Philadelphia, which administers child welfare here, to put a light on that part of it that was going on, because it too is a racket. The child welfare services, they're very trigger happy. They remove children from homes not where they face abuse or neglect, but basically because families are poor and children are snatched from these homes and put in foster care where they actually face a much higher rate of abuse. 30% of former foster children report an abuse by an adult in foster care. And children who are black face, black families are disproportionately impacted by this. When a family suspects that their children in foster care may be being abused, they are, turned around and attacked. They are told that they're lying to try to get their kids back and threatened with never seeing their children again if they complained. And your listeners probably heard that there were mothers, and there was one mother who was very outspoken who suspected the abuse, but nobody paid any attention to her. So when there is so much money being made, because every time a child is taken, the agency gets money, there's a bed that is filled, they get paid for the kids that are in care, there's a big financial incentive to keep kids in care instead of returning kids to families. And, many of these families, if they got the services and the money, the children would not needed to have been taken in the first place.
Yeah, and Phoebe, it's interesting to note that it was at while the jury actually considering what should happen to Sandusky, that one of his sons came out and said that he had been abused for years. And this was a young man now who was a foster child of the Sanduskys, and the Sanduskys later adopted him. And apparently his birth mother said that she was suspicious and that nobody was listening to her. So I guess that adds to the other mother that you were referring to, and it definitely ties in with Dr. Giroux's point about children basically being disposable. What we're going to do, we're just going to take a very short break. When we return, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Henry Giroux and Dr. Phoebe Jones. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty inside.
give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my
needs. Okay, and that's the late, great Whitney Houston, greatest love of all. Speaking of children, our guests are Dr. Henry Giroux, Dr. Phoebe Jones, and this is the Penn State sex abuse scandal that has gripped the nation and brought out so much information about not only the abuse of children over a 15-year period, but a cover-up which allowed the abuse to continue by key figures at Penn State, including the Pennsylvania Athletic Director, Tim Curley, of the famed football team, Gary Schultz, the school senior vice president for finance and business, Joe Paterno, the former Joe Paz, he was called, the coach of the famed team, and many others. And our guests are Dr. Henry Giroux, Dr. Phoebe Jones. So, Dr. Giroux, back to you for a moment. I mean, this idea of that, as you say, football and the famous football team and the continuing of the money that the Penn State football team brought in for the university had a much higher value than the children. I mean, nobody seemed to have been concerned about these children who were being raped, because when it comes to abuse of children, it's called everything else except rape. But when you've got a 10-year-old boy being abused by a man who's 60-plus years old, what else is it but rape? Dr. Henry Giroux.
Yeah, Margaret, it's really quite amazing. I mean, I'm just shocked at the euphemisms that we hear in the media when talking about these horrendous acts that were taken against these children. I mean, nobody talks about the fact that, you know, a 10-year-old boy was actually raped in a shower. I mean, and of course, as you know, when these acts were being discussed by Paterno and Spanier, and you probably know, I was at I worked at Penn State for 11 years. They talked about the most humane thing to do would essentially be to cover these acts up, and to make sure that Sandusky went into counseling. I mean, it sort of boggles the imagination, doesn't it? I mean, and it raises a more fundamental question, and that is, you know, to what degree do these market-driven values in their most extreme form really not only create a culture of corruption, but a culture of cruelty, a sort of enormous indifference to, particularly to young people who, you know, in some way, how we think about young people has changed dramatically since the 1980s, and they seem to exist now as our worst enemy. And as Phoebe sort of brilliantly suggested, I mean, the kind of industrial values, corporate commercial values that have now permeated so many of our institutions are doing such harm to children because they're seen as commodities. I mean, they're seen as disposable. They're seen as excess. They're not seen as, you know, a way to measure the index of any democracy. I mean, how we talk about and think about children is a measure of how we talk about democracy and how we feel about a democracy. And when we treat them as criminals, then it seems to me that that suggests something about the value system that we now find ourselves operating in and the power relations that support it.
Yeah, and Dr. Phoebe Jones, bringing you into this discussion, I mean, Dr. Giroux talks about what he calls a shameless and immoral war on youth. And in looking at the press release that your group issued back in December 2011, where you talk about how children from the poorest families are at greatest risk and that they have the least resources to protect their children from corruption. And Sandusky, I mean, this second mile charity that he founded seemed to have been a kind of a funnel for his access to children, but also the children who were victims were offered computers, access to games, and, you know, other resources, so that if you are from a family that can't afford these things, those children are much more vulnerable to become victims of people like Sandusky and the entire Penn State hierarchy there.
Absolutely. Phoebe. I mean, we were really raising the question, is child welfare a playground for rapists? I mean, it's a money racket for sure, but it also seemed to be a racket in terms of providing kids like a feeder, you know, for rape and abuse. And, you know, we called our protest Occupy at VHS, Protect Children, Not Profits. And we really wanted to make the connection with that the children are part of the 99% that the occupies around the world are talking about, and making that connection because it's so often hidden. And you know that rather than providing resources for those families that are the most vulnerable, either legal resources, housing. I mean, there's a statistic that a third of children would be home tomorrow if their parents just had decent housing. Rather than providing that, you know, they spend much more money to take kids, put them in care, and you know another point I wanted to make was that we've heard that you know there's more calls for mandatory reporting as a way to you know deal with this problem, but you know in fact that's just putting more kids at risk. All of those people, the child welfare, the Second Mile charity, you know, the people that were teachers, they already are mandatory reporters. They didn't do it because they were protecting other things other than the children. So, you know, we're really calling for the resources. We're calling for those responsible, you know, to be held to account. Who are those officials in child welfare services that knew and remained silent?
Yeah, and Phoebe, yeah. Apparently local child welfare services were informed, had some idea of Sandusky's behavior back in 1998.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
And that's according to the Penn State grand jury. That's not according to rumor.
Exactly, and they need to be, you know, dragged forth and so that this does not happen again in the protection of children in the future. So, you know, and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, we have some of the highest child removal rates in the country, and I know Los Angeles does also. So, you know, it's really a huge problem here.
Yeah, and back to you, Dr. Henry Giroux, because the debate right now focuses around, well, should the statue of Joe Paterno on the campus, which stands outside Beaver Stadium at Penn State campus, should it be removed? My personal view, frankly, it should. Then among ESPN, Mark Emmett and others are talking about punishing the Penn State football team and perhaps, you know, imposing severe sanctions, you know, on the team. And, you know, even I think it was David Zurin who writes for the Nation and is usually quite progressive. You know, he's talking about, well, this really isn't about football and, you know, the football players shouldn't be punished. But Giroux, it just seems to me as though nobody's really talking about people going to prison. These children were raped. I mean, university officials covered it up, refused to report it, and that allowed Sandusky continued access to these children. Why do you think that is the case? Everybody's talking about everything else except that.
I mean, I think that when you have the merging of power and privilege, it distorts the justice system, and it distorts the very notion of justice. And I think that those people who are the most vulnerable are the people who pay the price for that. I mean, I think that what Phoebe was saying earlier is something that needs to be amplified, and that is that, you know, when you have a society marked by enormous inequalities in wealth and power, the people who are the most vulnerable, who are afraid to speak out, the people who are the most prosecuted, the people who are seen as the most disposable, in many ways, are young people and the elderly, and people who are poor. And I think that what we see in this case is kind of an odd sort of narrative that operates around, you know, the fall of icons, the fall of a storied football program. That's not really the issue. I mean, the real issue is who's going to be held responsible for this? How can we make it clear that they're going to be held, that the institution is going to be held responsible and the people involved? And secondly, what do we learn from this about the nature of the society in which we live? I mean, how does this not become simply an isolated incident? How does it say something about the nature of the direction and the rise of authoritarian corporate forces in the United States that have made a mockery out of governance and made a mockery out of democracy. And who's paying the price for that? What happens when you live in a society when you separate questions of economics and power from questions of ethics and social responsibility? What's the price we pay? We have seen that at Penn State, we pay a terrible price. And somebody has to be held responsible, that's for sure.
Yes, and finally, also, Dr. Giroux, I mean, you talk about the kind of corruption that has seeped in to society with these market-driven values. And you make reference to institutional abuse like you see it at Penn State. But you also talk about Barclays and the recent crisis, the scandal that happened there, and, you know, the fixing of interest rate, not only Barclays banks, but most of the major banks around the world, the so-called LIBOR scandal. Also, it has come out that HSBC Bank, they have been basically funneling drug money from Mexico for the last 7 years, and that some officials knew about it. So why do you think connecting the dots, as you say, with Penn State and that other corruption?
I'll give you the example that I use in my Truth Out piece, which I think is interesting. I mean, GlaxoSmithKline basically paid a fine. One of the crimes that they committed was they were basically selling Paxil, pushing Paxil on to doctors to give to young kids when they knew that this drug had basically in some cases caused suicide in young people. Can you imagine? Mm. I mean, they actually attempted to skew the research on the drug, but for the sake of money, simply for the sake of increasing their profit margins, they were willing to push a drug that had already been in, for which they had been indicted by in New York in 2002, and they continued. And I guess what I was trying to say is that when you look at the likes of Jamie Dimon, when you look at the likes of Barclays with this massive LIBOR scandal involving, as you know, Margaret, trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
Think about justice and the question of scale. You get somebody who gets picked up for having 3 ounces of marijuana in their pocket, and in California, it's conceivable they could go to prison for life. You've got these corporate executives wreaking havoc on the economy. I mean, turning it into a casino, squandering all kinds of money, ruining people's lives, and all of a sudden, all that gets fined. What the company gets a fine that basically is irrelevant to them. It's so small. I mean, this is really the worst kind of political and moral corruption, and makes just a mockery out of any notion of democracy.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to end it there. Phoebe, I just wanted to give you the opportunity. Is there a website people could go to for the Every Mother's a Working Mother Network?
Yes, it's www.everymothernetwork.net. And I just want to add my voice that, you know, the accountability has to be, really key to this, because we cannot go on with business as usual.
Right. And Dr. Giroux, is there a website where people could access your work?
Yes, it's www.henryagiroux.com.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
We are going to take our station break now. And coming up, gentrification in downtown Los Angeles, including the recent Art Walk protest where there were several arrests of Occupy LA activists. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
KPFK's Spanish language public affairs programming airs from 9 p.m. to midnight every Monday through Thursday. KPFK is the only public radio station in Southern California that broadcasts news and public affairs in Spanish on weekdays. More than one-third of households in KPFK's vast signal area primarily speak Spanish, and half of those exclusively speak Spanish. Other than KPFK, these millions of people only have access to corporate-controlled broadcast media. KPFK, public media that serves all the public.
La programación en español de KPFK está al aire de 9 a 12 de la noche cada lunes a jueves.
KPFK is heard on K254 AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
You're listening to Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live around the world at kpfk.org.
People, and the country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who send the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. Now the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of our friends. But who are the ones that we call our friends?
And that is the music of Jackson Browne on the Occupy Movement. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio's KPFK, 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, streaming, podcasting worldwide on the web at kpfk.org. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, download, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. Coming up, downtown gentrification and the LA, the art walk protest by Occupy LA. But first, our weekly Earth Minute.
China's government recently announced a new plan to resettle Inner Mongolia's last remaining nomad populations by 2015. This would free up nearly 1 billion acres of grassland in China for development projects, including highways, rail lines, mines, and power plants. Traditional Mongol herders are protesting this plan that would resettle over 1 million people, and they accuse authorities of illegally taking away their grazing lands and extinguishing their traditional culture. China's actions violate their rights under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In early June, thugs hired by land grabbers clashed with traditional herders who were tending livestock on some of their last grazing lands. Many herders were beaten and two women were hospitalized with serious injuries. China's five-year settlement plan not only impacts Mongolia's nomads, but would affect remaining nomadic populations in Tibet. Land grabs such as these are increasing globally as countries and companies covet the territories of indigenous and rural peoples for land-intensive projects such as biofuel plantations and hydroelectric dams. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
And our weekly Earth Minute, and now to Occupy protests in Los Angeles and gentrification. The last few years has seen a dramatic process of gentrification in downtown Los Angeles. While many in City Hall, the business community, and some residents who can afford to pay a lot of money to buy expensive condos in downtown LA are heralding these changes as a rebirth of downtown, some activists and community groups are condemning what they see as a move to push out the poor and to criminalize homeless people. Occupy LA, along with a number of homeless rights organizations, have been fusing art and free speech, writing messages against gentrification on the streets of the city. The police, in turn, have been carrying out arrests, charging the chalk artists with vandalism. All of this came to a head when downtown activists handed out chalk at Art Walk, a popular monthly event in downtown Los Angeles last week, and were met with not only heavy police presence, but clashes broke out and there were mass arrests and there have been calls of police brutality. It remains to be seen if this turn of events will help or hurt the Occupy movement and the struggle against gentrification of LA's downtown. Here to discuss all of this with us, I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth, Pete White. Pete, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Pete White is the founder and co-director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, known as LA CAN, a grassroots organization working to ensure the human rights to housing, health, and security are upheld in Los Angeles and beyond. Pete White is a lifetime resident of South Central Los Angeles, and he says he's committed to fight for a Los Angeles that does not tolerate racial injustice, promotes an equitable distribution of resources, and includes everyone. And he and LA CAN are involved in a number of national coalitions and efforts. And Pete has served and currently serves on a number of boards of directors, including foundations and community-based organizations. And he believes that organizing and leadership development are essential tools needed to achieve social change and racial justice. So, Pete, first of all, tell us about this process of gentrification. What specifically has happened? Any specific projects you could point to? And what's the problem with them? A lot of people say, well, you know, it's really good that people, that downtown LA is now becoming a destination place for people to go and, you know, eat and basically entertain themselves. Pete White.
Yes. So this is Pete. So a quick primer on gentrification. First of all, we should realize that gentrification is a bad thing. It's very interesting. When we first started doing work against gentrification in downtown Los Angeles, you know, business interests, the mainstream media, and others knew it was a bad word, and they stayed away from it. Residents in downtown Los Angeles look forward to revitalization. Revitalization means you look at an area, you look at all of the inhabitants of that area, and you bring in opportunities for growth and housing and economic development for those who are currently in the community, as well as those who want to come and join the effort. Gentrification, on the other hand, is similar to urban renewal, quite frankly, when upper-income folks, and oftentimes this happens along racial lines, displace lower-income folks in communities. And so that process, anytime that we're talking about the rich versus the poor, and particularly when you're talking about upper-income white earners versus very poor black earners, it's oftentimes usually fraught with violence, displacement, and banishment from communities that have been long held bastions of color, quite frankly. And that has been the gentrification process that has been going on in downtown Los Angeles from the late 1990s.
Right. And Pete, what kind of revitalization would you like to see, and LA CAN would like to see, in downtown Los Angeles?
So for me, first and foremost, it is imperative that we deal with the social problems that exist in the community in a way that does not attempt to simply arrest your way out of poverty or push it somewhere else. And so, first and foremost, it is imperative that an investment is made into permanent housing and jobs for community residents who have long suffered disinvestment in that community as well as in the region. Let's be very clear, when we think about downtown Los Angeles and historically its roots, downtown has always been connected to Boyle Heights. It's always been connected to South Los Angeles. And so a real investment in the region into housing, jobs, and opportunities.
Yeah, and what about people? We know that the fastest growing number of homeless people in Los Angeles County are actually single mothers and children. And we also know there's a very high percentage of veterans who are homeless. And they're people who have particular issues, whether it is abuse or issues where they're not able to be in the wage workforce, either full-time or part-time. So what about those people?
I mean, it's interesting. I think that's a whole nother show for sure. But when we look at the foreclosure rate, you're absolutely right. Rising to the top are single mothers, usually mothers of color, who are finding themselves in the homeless ranks. But let's be very clear. It's something that Dr. King said in 1964, that poverty is the greatest form of violence that we continue to suffer. And so it's not just about this moment, these momentary spats, recessions, depressions. We're talking about communities who have lived in, like, who continue to live in depression-like conditions over the last 100 years. And what we see in those communities is disinvestment has been a way of business. And so when opportunity for the business community arrives by means of communities that have been forgotten, lower land values, then the sweep, if you will, comes in to remove those folks who have pretty much stayed on the land when it was at its worst.
Right. And it does seem to me as though people do need resources for food, housing, et cetera, whether or not they are in the traditional wage workforce or not. But Pete White, I'd like you to tell us about the community, about the Central City Association. What is the Central City Association? There've been occupation going on outside Central City Association and a lot of focus by Occupy LA activists on Central City Association. Why?
And so let me first say that the Central City Association is one of the most powerful business interests in downtown Los Angeles and across the Los Angeles region. They are the king and queen makers for Los Angeles politics. If you look on the Ethics Committee, you will see very quickly that their membership and their organization supports candidates at high rates in terms of resources. It's called now the Central City Association, but in the 20s, when it was founded, it was called the Downtown Businessmen's Organization. Now think about that, 1920 Downtown Businessmen's Organization. So they've had a long time to build their raucous way. They are good at what they do. They have an army of lobbyists who are in City Hall on a daily basis. A lot of the policy that was created to pave the way for gentrification in downtown was established by this business organization.
Mm-hmm.
There on their website, it boasts that they are the most powerful Rolodex of they're a membership organization of the most powerful Rolodex in Los Angeles. So they're unabashed in their power and the way that they work. The LA Can campaign, our work, has definitely been to mitigate the impacts of the Central City East Association over the last 10 years. It was one of their early policies, the Adaptive Reuse Ordinance, which made it possible to turn old office buildings into housing, which we've, which really raised our attention to the organization. But the biggest thing that LA Can has always sort of run up against with the Central City Association is the fact that they have continued to insist that our community does not exist. And so in their development plans for gentrification, when they saw the downtown residential hotels, which is permanent housing for individuals, they did not see those residents as community residents. They saw those residents as transient. And so we had problems with that, because if you come into a community and don't realize that a community exists, it makes it very easy to attempt to banish that community and to arrest your way out of the poverty that exists.
Yeah. And Pete White, what we want to do is we want to open the phone lines so we could have as many of our listeners as we could fit in weigh in on this discussion, the arrest that happened of Occupy LA at the Art Walk for drawing, using chalk to draw on the sidewalk. The number to call is 818-985-5735. And this is on gentrification and versus revitalization of downtown Los Angeles. And the arrests that happened last week by LAPD. There's now been a call for an investigation of how police handle that situation. Again, the number to call us is 818-985-5735. If you have a view on any of those issues, we would like to hear from you. Again, that number to call is 818-985-5735. On the line with us is Pete White. And what do you think about what is happening now in downtown Los Angeles? Again, that number is 818-985-5735. So, Pete White, what about what happened last week with the protests? What was the purpose of the protests? And, I mean, this idea that you could use chalk to draw on the sidewalk, which could then be hosed down, being criminalized is really shocking to a lot of people. Pete White, again, that number is 818-985-5735. If you want to be on the air and give your view, please call us 818-985-5735. Pete White.
So let me just say, Margaret, I think it's important, and this is where public radio and your show is very important. It's important to note that the arrest for talking has been going on over the last 45 days or so. So it isn't as if the arrest just started at Art Walk on last Thursday. The Los Angeles Community Action Network and Occupy LA have targeted the Central City Association for all the obvious reasons, because they represent the gentry. At each time that we actually protest at one of their mixers or at one of their executive committee meetings, within minutes, the police deployment outnumbers 2-1, 3-1, the number of protesters that are there. So police have been arresting people for chalk. But also, this is one thing that listeners don't know, is that when we have our protest signs on the street next to us, police are arresting individuals for a code called 5611, which says you cannot store personal property on a sidewalk. And it's usually geared toward business merchants who store their property outside of their businesses. And so this arresting, this sort of enforcement against dissent has been going on for quite some time.
Well, let us hear now from one of our callers. And also, on Friday in our roundtable, Tom Hayden made the comment that he thinks the Occupy movement is dead. If you have a view on that comment, also call us. The number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Curtis of Los Angeles, you're on the air. Thank you for listening and calling. Curtis.
Yeah. Hi, thank you. I live downtown on 6th and Spring, and you can kind of feel the tension last week when the chalk started moving out into the street from the sidewalk, and the cops are pretty heavy-handed. But at the same time, you know, when I was a kid, you'd come downtown, and it was rough back in the 80s and 90s, and I finally moved down here because it seemed like it was ready, and it's probably the most diverse community in the entire L.A. County.
Yeah.
Because of development, because of redevelopment.
All righty. So what about the difference between gentrification and revitalization, as our guest spoke about, Curtis? And again, the number to call is 818-985-5735.
Well, I think, you know, gentrification can be kind of aggressive. I'm a geographer, and so I study, you know, patterns. But you have to have... It's been sitting for so long. It's almost like downtown was wrapped in cosmoline for the last 2-3 decades, and now you're finally able to pull back some of the layers of whatever and get to some of these theaters and use them and the film locations. I understand that a lot of these developers, though, when they go into these hotels, that they still retain a certain amount of low income housing. Isn't that true?
Yeah, okay, Curtis, we'd like to fit in a few more callers here, and then we'll give you a chance, Pete, to respond. Ben from Los Angeles. Ben, thank you for listening and calling.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Are
okay. You there? Yes, we're here. You're on the air.
Okay. What I want to say is that all these things that are happening, that are being reported on KPFK, are not reaching the majority of the people in the country. So my suggestion is that you recommend to every and all organization that you interview that have hundreds of followers, that they find a way to put pressure on all the media, Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 6, if they have hundreds of people calling and putting pressure on them to report what you report, I think that within 6 months to a year, there will be a revolution in this country.
All righty, Ben, we would certainly...
The people are not getting the message. That's the problem.
All righty, Ben from Los Angeles, thank you for your calling and suggestion. Sharon in Alhambra. Sharon, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me on. I'd like to say that I'm in my 60s, and I believe in demonstrations. I don't have to agree with the demonstrations, but police should not be able to just outnumber people and try to prevent them from stating, whether they be by signs or by... Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
I would like to say that people should be able to demonstrate.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sharon in Alhambra, Orlando and Granada Hills. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Thank you for letting me express myself over there. I have an interview with one of the channels that's 62 Spanish channel, you know, about the Occupy. They gave me 15 seconds to express my view about what happened. And they already have everything framed, you know, in order for me just to say a little bit about the Occupy. I am from the Occupy LA. I just want to respond to specific to the comment that Mr. Tom Hayden said last week in your program about this time.
Yes.
Friday. Okay, Mr. Tom Hayden, please, you know, from your mansion that you live over there, and that's in Beverly Hills, on the mountains over there where you live, there is not Occupy movement anymore. But those many hundreds of people who leave the houses, their houses, talking about young people who live in the street now, and there are hundreds of them, you know, and they keep the movement alive.
Yeah.
I mean, the progressive movement alive.
Okay.
So you don't have any right from your mansion over there to criticize these people, young people, you know, that is doing this work that you never did, you know. You never did. So please, refrain from those comments, because it doesn't help. The movement, Occupy movement, is alive and very vital.
Yeah, I happen to think it's alive. What we want to do is that the phone lines are really going here. We need to give Pete White just a chance to quickly respond to some of what you've heard. And clearly, we're going to have to open the lines more on this particular discussion. Pete, some final comments from you. Hello, Pete?
I'm here, but you got to call us today.
All righty. For some reason, Pete White, we are not hearing you.
Okay, I'm here now.
Okay, very good.
And so, real quickly, to my geographer neighbor that was on the phone earlier, the reason that downtown Los Angeles is still a mixed community is because of a 6-year campaign waged by residents in the Los Angeles Community Action Network that ensured, it's called the Permanent Housing Ordinance, that ensured that residents, poor residents, would not be removed from the community. And so that is why you see such a rich, vibrant community. However, let us be very clear that while, you know, a policy has been won and a victory has been won, there are still everyday pressures to remove people from that community, people of color, through arrest, through intimidation, through harassment. This idea that the Occupy movement is dead, you cannot kill an idea. This idea resonates amongst the masses of individuals, and what you see is a resurgence of political activity.
Yeah.
And it might all be in the name of Occupy, but we must be very clear that the Occupy movement distilled in folks in a way that, you know, other movements in this country, the need to stand up and to respond.
Right. Well, Pete White of L.A. Can. I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We'll have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. Those of you who called and didn't get through, please go to our Facebook, Sojourner Truth Radio. We'd love to get your comment. You can follow us on Twitter at So True Radio on Facebook. Please like us. Look for Sojourner Truth Radio. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott, engineer Teddy Robinson. We'd like to thank our team, Teresa McGee, Azim Khan, Eric Doyle, and assistant producer Sarah Shakur. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Stay tuned for some special programming. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening and for calling. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
On the radio, talk shows, on the TV, you hear one thing again and again. Now the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend.